piece in the presidency coverage right here or at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Democracy Now! Breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency.
We hereby nominate every single one of them for the greatest president that's ever lived, and that's Donald J. Trump. Hereby declaring him the Republican nominee for president of the United States of America.
The Republican Party has officially nominated Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. We'll look at Trump's pick for vice president, who once described Trump as America's Hitler. We'll look at how J.D. Vance wants police to track people who have abortions. That's the headline of a lever piece. Then a federal court has rejected a lawsuit accusing President Biden of being complicit in genocide in Gaza. We'll speak to attorney Catherine Gallagher of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
In the face of all of this, the United States, when it has continued to send weapons, to send military advisors, to rush aid and give moral and political support to Israel's actions, we say it is aiding and abetting genocide.
All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We are breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Donald Trump has selected freshman Ohio Senator J.D. Vance as his running mate. Republicans celebrated the decision while Democrats warned against Vance's extremist views, with President Biden labeling him a clone of Trump. The 39-year-old former Marine gained fame after writing the best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis about growing up in Appalachia. He won a close Republican Senate primary in 2022, in part thanks to the billionaire tech investor Peter Thiel, who poured a record-breaking $10 million to support his campaign. J.D. Vance's political positions have shifted dramatically over the years. Once a Trump critic, Vance went on to embrace the MAGA movement and far-right positions on abortion, the climate, immigration, and other issues. Donald Trump returned to the public eye on Monday for the first time since Saturday's assassination attempt, appearing alongside Vance wearing a bandage over his right ear as Republican delegates formally nominated the pair to the 2024 Republican ticket. Climate activists are among those sounding the alarm over the selection of J.D. Vance. The group Sunrise Movement cited his track record of voting to gut the EPA, his denial of climate change, and the fossil fuel industry's contributions to Vance's campaign. J.D. Vance previously acknowledged the need to take on the climate crisis before taking a hard right turn on the issue. On Monday, the group Climate Defiance posted a video of its activists disrupting a J.D. Vance gala dinner, vowing to continue targeting Vance now that he's the vice presidential nominee.
J.D. Vance is a climate supervillain. He's a criminal.
head of UNRWA, the UN's Palestinian Refugee Agency, said its Gaza headquarters has been, quote, flattened and turned into a battlefield, unquote, as Israeli forces continue their scorched earth campaign in Gaza City. Turkey's condemned Israel's military for destroying the Turkish-Palestinian Friendship Hospital, Gaza's only specialized cancer center, after using it as a military base for months. Turkish officials said it's further proof of Israel's, quote, systematic policy aimed at the annihilation of the Palestinian people, unquote, and vowed to pursue Israel in international courts. In Khan Yunis, waste management officials say trash is piling up amidst the massive destruction and the Israeli blockade on fuel and water, adding to a growing public health and sanitation crisis.
Khan Yunis city has faced great damage, amounting to over 200 million in the infrastructure, sewage systems, waste trucks, and cleaning systems, in addition to the lack of fuel, which is the main pillar in operating the cleaning and sewage systems. The piling up of waste has led to bad smells, spread of insects and rodents, in addition to leakage of liquids from the waste to the underground water reservoir, which is the main source of water for the residents of Khan Yunis and Gaza enclave generally.
Here in the United States, Secretary of State Antony Blinken told two top Israeli officials the civilian death toll in Gaza is unacceptably high during an Israeli visit to Washington, D.C. Israel's killed at least 38,700 Palestinians in Gaza since October 7th, though the true death toll is likely much higher. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is still expected to address a joint session of Congress on July 24th, despite the reported concern about the death toll and mounting objections among Democrats to Netanyahu's appearance. A federal panel has upheld the dismissal of a lawsuit filed by a group of Palestinian Americans against President Biden and other officials for failing to prevent genocide in Gaza. The court previously dismissed the suit on jurisdictional grounds, but ruled that it's plausible that Israel is engaging in genocide. The lawsuit was brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights. Go to democracynow.org to see our coverage of the case. We'll talk more about it later in the broadcast. A federal judge in Florida has dismissed special counsel Jack Smith's criminal case against Donald Trump over his mishandling of classified documents after leaving the White House. On Monday, Trump appointed U.S. District Judge Aileen Cannon sided with Trump's lawyers, who argued Attorney General Merrick Garland's appointment of the special counsel was unlawful because Smith had not been appointed by Biden or confirmed by the Senate. Cannon also ruled Smith had been improperly funded by the Treasury Department. Cannon's legal rationale drew from a concurring opinion by far-right Justice Clarence Thomas in the Supreme Court's historic ruling Trump v. United States, which grants presidents broad immunity from prosecution. A federal grand jury had indicted Trump on 40 felony counts, 32 violations of the Espionage Act for willful retention of national defense information, and another 8 counts of obstructing justice. The Justice Department's expected to appeal the ruling, but the legal victory has given Trump another boost as he officially accepts the presidential nomination this week at the Republican National Convention. Democrats slammed the decision by Judge Cannon. President Biden called the dismissal specious. Meanwhile, Florida Republican lawmaker Matt Gaetz reacted to the news by calling Aileen Cannon a, quote, future Supreme Court justice. Meanwhile, in New York, a federal judge Friday dismissed Rudy Giuliani's bankruptcy protection case, clearing the way for creditors to potentially seize his assets. Giuliani had sought bankruptcy protection after a jury in December awarded two Georgia election workers $148 million in their defamation case against Giuliani following the 2020 election. Environmental groups renewed calls for a ban on deep-sea mining Monday as the International Seabed Authority opened its annual summit in Jamaica. More than two dozen nations attending the talks have called for a moratorium on deep-sea mining, which creates massive sediment plumes and can devastate marine ecosystems. In a statement, the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition wrote, quote, the deep ocean sustains crucial processes that make the entire planet habitable, from driving ocean currents that regulate our weather to storing carbon and buffering our planet against the impacts of climate change, unquote. Bolivia's president has announced plans to exploit a vast natural gas reserve north of Bolivia's administrative capital, La Paz. President Luis Arce said Monday the discovery of 1.7 trillion cubic feet of gas would once again make Bolivia a major exporter of fossil fuels.
It will mark the beginning of a new chapter for the northern sub-Andean region. It offers the hope of maintaining our country as an important gas exporter, driving a second era of hydrocarbon production and positioning La Paz as a department that is now a hydrocarbon producer.
Bolivia is already South America's largest exporter of natural gas, although its shipments are dwarfed by the world leader, the United States. Scorching temperatures continue to bake large swaths of the Midwest and eastern U.S. as a heat dome blankets the region. Some 100 million people are under heat advisories from New York to Florida to Texas. Meanwhile, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, and much of eastern North Carolina and southeast Virginia are under excessive heat warnings, with temperatures expected to rise to some 100 degrees Fahrenheit. On the West Coast, the blistering heat has intensified wildfires across Oregon, where at least 8 blazes are burning. Oregon's largest blaze, the Cow Valley Fire, has burnt over 132,000 acres. Wildfires are also raging in parts of California and Hawaii. In Gambia, lawmakers have voted to uphold legislation banning female genital mutilation. The vote comes after Gambia's National Assembly in March approved a move to repeal the landmark 2015 ban on female genital cutting. Some lawmakers say they were willing to lose their seat by speaking out against the practice.
What is wrong shall never be right. This is wrong, and I will start to say it's wrong. Even it is taking me to lose this seat, I was ready to resign and said, look, I will not be a part of a legislative that will tend to return my country in those old age.
In Nigeria, at least 22 students were killed after a two-story school in the community of Busabuji collapsed during morning classes Friday. Over 100 students at the Saints Academy became trapped in the rubble. Many of the school students are 15 or younger. Local officials vowed to investigate as the families of the victims gathered near the school to mourn their loved ones. This is Victor Dennis, whose son, Emmanuel, was killed in the school collapse.
I went there to see the collapsed building, a two-story building. So people were helping to rescue the students. My two girls, one jumped out. They rescued the other one. My boy was down. It took some time before they brought him out from the rubble. He had injury on his head. I saw his dead body in the mortuary.
And Peter Buxton, the U.S. government whistleblower who exposed the Tuskegee syphilis study, has died at 86. Starting in 1966, Buxton started sounding the alarm when he learned about the ongoing experiment as a federal public health employee. The government-led study, which started in 1932, observed 400 black men in rural Alabama who had syphilis but were denied antibiotic treatment so scientists could observe the disease's progression. It wasn't until 1972 that the study came into full view of the public and Congress when AP reporter Edith Lederer published a story about the case using information passed on to her by Buxton. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now! Breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. Coming up, we look more at Donald Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, who once described Trump as America's Hitler. by Velvet Underground and Nico. This is Democracy Now!, War, Peace, and the Presidency. We are breaking with convention. I'm Amy Goodman. Donald Trump has tapped freshman Ohio Senator J.D. Vance to be his running mate. Trump and Vance were officially nominated on Monday on the opening day of the Republican National Convention.
It is a great honor to move that J.D. Vance be nominated by acclamation by this Republican National Convention as its candidate for the office of Vice President of the United States of America.
J.D. Vance, who's 39, first gained fame as the author of the best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis about growing up in Appalachia. The book was also made into a movie. Vance is a graduate of Yale Law School, who served in the Marines and became a venture capitalist. He was also a never-Trumper, who once called Trump America's Hitler. Reprehensible, cultural heroin, as in the drug. Noxious, a terrible candidate. But Vance later shifted and became an ardent supporter of Donald Trump. Vance won a close Republican Senate primary in 2022, in part thanks to billionaire tech investor Peter Thiel, who spent a record-breaking $10 million to support Vance's campaign. Earlier this year, J.D. Vance appeared on ABC and told George Stephanopoulos if he had been vice president in 2020, he would not have certified the results of the 2020 election.
Would you have certified the election results had you been vice president?
If I had been vice president, I would have told the states like Pennsylvania, Georgia, and so many others that we needed to have multiple slates of electors, and I think the U.S. Congress should have fought over it from there. That is the legitimate way to deal with an election that a lot of folks, including me, think had a lot of problems in 2020. I think that's what we should have done.
So it's very clear you would have done what Donald Trump asked you to do there, not what Mike, President Mike Pence did. You said that that's about the past.
But no, George, it's not about what Donald Trump asks somebody to do. It's about what do we do when you have a problem like what happened in 2020.
To look more at J.D. Vance's record and economic policies, we're joined now by Robert Kuttner, co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. His recent piece, headlined Trump's VP Reveal, Kuttner's latest book, is titled Going Big, FDR's Legacy, Biden's New Deal, and the Struggle to Save Democracy. He's also a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. Robert Kuttner, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you,
thank you for having me,
tell us who J.D. Vance is and the significance of Donald Trump choosing him, who would be the youngest ever vice president if he were to win, at the age of 39, the former Marine and venture capitalist?
Well, he's a very dangerous fake, and his whole history from writing Hillbilly Elegy to doing a 180-degree pivot from being a critic of Trump to being a loyalist to Trump to pretending to be very favorable to working Americans when, in fact, all of his votes have been the opposite, suggests both that he's a fake and he's an attractive fake. He's personally likable. I hate to say that. He's an intellectual. He knows how to engage issues. He knows things that Trump is completely ignorant of. He's young, whereas Trump is old. And when I wrote this piece yesterday morning, before Trump had made his selection, I wrote that if Trump is shrewd, he will name J.D. Vance, but I'm not sure that Trump's own narcissism will let him do that, because the risk for Trump is that Vance will upstage Trump. And let me say a word or two about Hillbilly Elegy, because this was a classic case of bait and switch. So the story is that he's got a dysfunctional family. They move from southern Ohio to Kentucky. And supposedly, the book is expressing great compassion for his kin and his neighbors. But the actual message of the book is that if you're not doing well in Kentucky, it's because of your own bad behavior. You're taking too many drugs, you're selling your food stamps, you're not able to hold a job, you're not doing right by your children. It's the old conservative narrative that poverty is the fault of the poor. It's all behavioral, it's not structural, it's not industry being outsourced or the coal mines closing. No, it's just your behavior's bad. And, you know, the right-wing foundations invested in a guy named Charles Murray, who wrote a book in the 80s called Losing Ground, which basically said that poverty is the fault of the war on poverty, and poverty is the fault of the welfare system, and poverty is the fault of spoiling the poor. And in that, the review that I wrote of his book, I described Vance as Charles Murray with a shit-eating grin. And when I met Vance at a conference the following year, he quoted that line back to me and engaged intellectually and was very self-reflective and thoughtful and likable. And I said to myself, uh-oh, this guy is really going to be trouble. And so what they did last night, they repositioned the Republican Party as the party that's pro-worker, even though this is complete nonsense. But because Vance is so adept at these head fakes, and because he's got this fake, compelling life story, he's the ideal guy to try and represent that. And they were so cynical that they even put Sean O'Brien on the program, who sort of threaded the needle between talking about what we needed to do to give unions a fighting chance without quite mentioning that Biden was the one who was in favor of this. And it was the Republicans who were blocking this. This is very clever on the part of Republicans to reposition themselves, at least for the purpose of the convention and maybe for the campaign, from being the party of hatred to being the party that cares about workers. It's nonsense, but Vance is a very good symbol of that, and that's why he's so dangerous. And, you know, normally it really doesn't matter who the vice president is. You have to go all the way back to 1960 to point to a vice president, Lyndon Johnson, who really made a difference in an election outcome. He helped Kennedy carry Texas and maybe won the election. But other than that, vice president doesn't matter very much. In this case, where you've got very closely fought races in Wisconsin and in Michigan and in Ohio, well, not Ohio, but Ohio where Sherrod Brown is concerned anyway, and in western Pennsylvania, Vance could actually make a difference. The only silver lining, and I hate to call this a silver lining, is it makes it even more urgent for the Democrats to find somebody more effective than Biden who can beat these guys. And I think once the hoopla from the Republican convention dies down, you know, by next weekend, that's going to be the takeaway, that we are really screwed if we can't find somebody who can beat this ticket. And the ticket is beatable. You just need a stronger candidate than Biden.
You mentioned the Teamsters president, Sean O'Brien. This was very significant. It was the first time a Teamsters president addressed the Republican National Convention. It was the first night of the convention. President Trump and his vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance, were sitting next to each other in the audience. The Teamsters president gave something like an 18-minute final speech. This is a clip.
I travel all across this country and meet with my members every week. You know what I see? An American worker being taken for granted. Workers being sold out to big banks, big tech, corporates, and the elite. And I'm not the only one who sees this. Everyday families see it. The American people aren't stupid. They know the system is broken. We all know how Washington is run. Working people have no chance of winning this fight. That's why I'm here today. Because I refuse to keep doing the same things my predecessors did. Teamsters are here to say we are not beholden to anyone or any party. We will create an agenda and work with a bipartisan coalition
ready to accomplish something real for the American worker. And I don't care about getting criticized. It's an honor to be the first Teamster in our 121-year history to address the Republican National Convention.
So that was Teamsters President Sean O'Brien in this rousing address to not the Democratic National Convention. Apparently, he asked to address both conventions. Only the Republicans, he said, got back to him. Robert Kuttner, your co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect, your response as he talked about what we just heard. He talked about economic terrorism. He called out corporations like Amazon. You say that J.D. Vance is anti-worker. Explain what the role of the Teamsters president is here. I know there's a lot of dissent within the Teamsters for him giving this address.
Well, it was pretty cynical of O'Brien. I mean, on the one hand, it gave him a platform to give a very pro-worker speech. On the other hand, there's no bipartisan coalition on behalf of raising the minimum wage or strengthening worker organizing rights or strengthening the NLRB or any of the other things on the pro-worker agenda. The only people who are supporting that are Democrats. And even someone like J.D. Vance, who does head fakes as a kind of a pro-worker guy, he's not voting for this stuff either. So, to some extent, this is in the Teamster DNA. You know, there were points when Jimmy Hoffa backed Republicans, and it's a union over the years that's been fairly opportunist politically. And O'Brien is gambling that, A, this gives him a platform. B, if these guys get elected, he's going to have some relationship with him. They sort of owe him a favor. I don't think it was a great idea, but at least it tested out some themes on a Republican audience and demonstrated the awkwardness of Republicans claiming to be pro-worker, because if you dig a little bit beneath the surface, the Republicans are against every one of these things, and I'm hardly the only commentator who's going to point that out.
But Robert Kuttner, if you could say how they're against it, show through their records, Vance, a senator, of course, Trump, former president, how they're anti-worker, because this right-wing populist appeal, the Teamsters president addressing, seeing the reactions of the presidential and vice presidential candidate was very powerful.
Well, you look at everything from Biden's executive orders that make it easier for workers to organize to Biden's executive orders requiring federal contractors to pay a living wage to decisions by the NLRB on unfair labor practices to raising the minimum wage to defining Uber and Lyft workers as regular employees. I mean, you go down the entire litany of things that unions want. The Republicans have opposed every one of them, either in court or by statute or in recorded votes or Republican appointees on regulatory commissions. And although Vance once walked a picket line with the UAW, he has not done anything to support the labor agenda. It's all image, it's all fakery, it's all political stunts. And the more that comes out into the open, the more people realize that the Republican effort last night to present itself as the pro-worker party is nothing but posturing, and they need to be held to account on that. It should be a very major issue in the campaign. The more Republicans try and make their alleged pro-worker stance a high-profile posture, the more they need to be held to account.
If people were just reading the script of Sean O'Brien's speech, it could have been one given by Independent Senator Bernie Sanders. Are the Democrats at risk here of dismissing this level of right-wing populism? And you, can you talk about why it appeals so much, especially in the states, the battleground states of Ohio and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, where we are right now?
Well, what's truly dangerous about Vance, if you compare Vance with Trump, so the Trump of 2016 posed as a populist, but it was cultural or social or racist populism. It's all the fault of Mexicans. It's all the fault of immigrants. It's all the fault of, you know, DEI. This was a kind of an attempt to play into the feeling of white working class people that they have been disrespected. And it was a racist, nationalist, cultural brand of fake populism. Now, what Vance brings to this is he tries to add economic populism. Not only are we going to seal up the Mexican border, but we're actually going to help you earn a living wage. And Trump didn't really do that, other than raising tariffs on Chinese goods and being anti-China. Trump didn't follow through on that. It was left to Biden to complement the tariffs with a real industrial policy. Trump was opposed to that. Whereas Vance is much more effective at connecting Trump's cultural and social and racist populism to what looks like pocketbook populism, except it's a fake. So that if you're a worker in Wisconsin or Ohio or Pennsylvania, and your living standards have gone to hell, and you can't send your kid to college because your child would have to go into debt, and you can't afford to buy a house, and your health insurance is going down the drain, those are pocketbook issues. And to the extent that Vance talks a good game on pocketbook issues, that shores up Trump's rather thin cultural populism. So it's dangerous. And I come back to the fact that the Democrats have got to do better than Biden if they're going to contest this. I mean, Biden's done great stuff, but the number of Americans who think he's too old, he's too fragile, he's too feeble, the fact that he can't keep his line straight, and the fact that Vance, by the way, is an excellent debater. We got to do better than the current Democratic ticket, or these guys are going to win. And they're cynical enough to carry out all their threats. And we really will cease to be a democracy. And you can change the title of your program to Democracy Then.
I want to turn to a few of the responses last night. It was right after J.D. Vance was announced as the vice presidential candidate. Again, he would be, if he won, the second youngest vice president in U.S. history. I spoke to Republican House Speaker, the former Speaker, Kevin McCarthy of California, serving as a delegate to the convention. Mr. McCarthy, your thoughts on J.D. Vance?
I think it's a great pick. I mean, I think J.D. will be able to go places that you don't really normally see Republicans. I think he'll be great in Pennsylvania and in Michigan and Wisconsin. And, you know, we got to win one of those three to be able to win where we are. I think his work as in the Marines, his economics, I mean, his youthfulness, I think it's going to be a great addition. Great team.
What do you think of him having called Trump America's Hitler?
I think that was a long time ago, and he's learned something new. I think you're going to find a lot of people that maybe voted against President Trump 2016 that are going to be supporting him now.
Not far from the former House Speaker McCarthy, I spoke to California Republican delegate Lisa Moreno. What is your name?
Lisa Moreno.
And where do you live in California?
Madera County.
What do you think of the choice of J.D. Vance?
That's what we are. We're a unified party, and we're in it to win it. We're taking care of business, and we're taking our country back.
So let me ask you something. J.D. Vance said Trump makes Because of this, I find him reprehensible. God wants better of us. Vance said this on Twitter a few years ago. What are your thoughts about that?
First of all, I proudly represent being Latina and being Republican. So our party welcomes everyone from all walks of life, from all backgrounds. I have heard so much rhetoric from other people that are not Republican say to me, I don't identify with my party anymore. They're on the opposite side of the spectrum. I need to find a home. And I say to them, our arms are open and welcome. Why else do you want to come over? And they say, we're tired of the last 4 years. We don't like what it feels like. We want to go back. And they're not Republican. They're Latinos. They're Black. They're Asian. They're Indian. They're coming to us without us having to go. We'll ask them to come over and tap them on the shoulder, but we have our arms very much open to them.
But it's J.D. Vance who is saying this, that President Trump makes people I care about afraid, like immigrants.
Right. It was Kamala Harris that said to Joe Biden on the debate stage that she was Black and she was asked to go sit at the back of the bus, or there was discrimination in her time or segregation, and she's his vice president.
What are you hoping will come out of this convention?
I'm sorry?
What do you hope will come out of this convention?
We're already unified. We're already ready to take our country back. What I'm hoping to see out of this convention is that the whole world to see a unified party like never before. After the attempted assassination of a husband, a father, and a fearless leader, the world and the United States and everybody from all colors, walks of life saw the division in our country, and people that were not going to vote for Trump are now voting because they've had enough. A lot of people have had it.
That was California Republican delegate Lisa Moreno straining over the music on the floor of the Republican National Convention here in Milwaukee at the Fiserv Center. Robert Kuttner, if you can respond, whether J.D. Vance was attacking Trump around discrimination against immigrants or had called him America's Hitler. The response of the Republicans, and this goes also to the dissent within the Democratic Party right now and the pushing for Biden to step aside.
You know, there's one interesting crack in the Republican unity. Rupert Murdoch and the Wall Street Journal tried very, very, very hard to discourage Trump from naming J.D. Vance. And I think the reason is that twofold. First of all, Wall Street Journal is very neocon in its foreign policy. It's kind of, you know, America needs to police the world. And secondly, the Wall Street Journal is very corporate. To the extent that Vance is something of an economic populist, or at least poses as one, he doesn't represent the corporate wing of the Republican Party. And to the extent that he's criticized America's help of Ukraine to fend off Russia's invasion, he is feared to be isolationist. So the corporate wing of the Republican Party doesn't like him. And he's actually pivoted on a couple of interesting things. He defends Social Security. So they're very good at paying attention to the things that ordinary working people care about without moving more than a couple of inches in that direction. And I think that's what makes him so dangerous. And that's why the Democrats, once the hoopla of the Republican convention's over, you're going to see this talk about, boy, do we have to get Biden out of there, resume very, very quickly. For now, in the aftermath of the assassination attempt, there's politeness, there's unity, they pulled the commercials, but you're going to see this roaring back to life, and I certainly, for one person, I certainly hope it does.
Robert Kuttner, I want to thank you for being with us, co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. We'll link to your piece, Trump's VP Reveal, Kuttner's latest book, Going Big, FDR's Legacy, Biden's New Deal, and the Struggle to Save Democracy. This is War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. We're broadcasting from the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm Amy Goodman. J.D. Vance wants police to track people who have abortions. That's the headline of a new article just published by the investigative news outlet The Lever, which looks at how Vance pressured federal regulators last June to kill a privacy rule that prevents police from accessing the medical records of people seeking reproductive health care. We're joined now by the report's author, Veronica Recobene. She's a producer and reporter with The Lever. Veronica, lay out what you found.
Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for having me on. First off, the Biden administration last spring proposed a rule in its draft form expanding HIPAA protections under the Department of Health and Human Services. Traditionally, HIPAA protections, which keep medical information private, don't extend to law enforcement investigations. So if a criminal investigation is open, police can subpoena for records, for medical records. However, the Biden administration, the rule which was then proposed at the time, makes it so that not even police can access reproductive health records specifically. This rule was made keeping in mind that states like Alabama have passed laws making it illegal for women to leave the state to obtain abortions and seeking to criminalize abortions. After this proposed rule was introduced by the Biden administration, J.D. Vance, along with other congressional Republicans, wrote a letter pressuring the administration to repeal this rule. They said that it was an overstepping of HHS's bounds and an inclusion on congressional authority.
So talk about exactly what J.D. Vance's role was in pushing for police to track, and talk about who he wants tracked.
Right. So what this law does is that it makes these medical records private, specifically people who are seeking reproductive health. So it goes without saying that the people that J.D. Vance wants to track are people who are seeking abortions. He played a principal role in writing this letter and signing it. The letter was not successful. The rule went into place anyway. But what's really shocking and scary about this story is that the rule was just implemented by the Biden administration. It wasn't signed into law. So an incoming Trump administration could potentially repeal it. And considering that J.D. Vance himself has stood up as kind of a crusade against this specific rule, I'm personally afraid for that.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk about J.D. Vance's position on abortion, how it has changed, or should I say positions on abortion?
Yes, similar to former President Trump, he's a little bit all over the place. Personally, it seems that he's morally against abortion. He has always stated that he doesn't believe in abortion, specifically he doesn't believe in it in cases for exceptions for rape or incest. He said famously that two wrongs don't make a right. Gearing up to his announcement, though, he kind of leaned back a little bit on the anti-abortion rhetoric. He recently, though he supports a national ban of 15 weeks, he recently told George Stephanopoulos that he doesn't support a ban against the abortion pill. He also said that he believes it should be a state issue, doesn't support a national abortion ban. That being said, you know, his support of breaking down this rule would essentially make abortion illegal everywhere. What he says he believes and what is actually in paper is quite different.
I want to go to a clip you just referenced. Speaking in 2021 to Spectrum News in Ohio, J.D. Vance was asked whether he supported abortion exceptions in cases of rape and incest.
Wrongs don't make a right.
At the end of the day, we're talking about an unborn baby. What kind of society do we want to have? A society that looks at unborn babies as inconveniences to be discarded? Should a woman be forced to carry a child to term after she has been the victim of incest or rape? Look, my view on this has been very clear, and I think the question betrays a certain presumption that's wrong. It's not whether a woman should be forced to bring a child to term, it's whether a child should be allowed to live, even though the circumstances of that child's birth are somehow inconvenient or a problem to the society. The question really to me is about the baby. We want women to have opportunities, we want women to have choices, but above all, we want women and young boys in the womb to have the right to life.
So that was J.D. Vance in 2021 calling rape an inconvenience, Veronica?
Yeah. His record specifically speaking on women is not great. He's made references to crazy cat ladies before. It seems that he has like a very strong moral position that abortion is murder. And he wants to follow through on that by criminalizing it for everyone who seeks one and anyone who helps perform one.
Do you feel that J.D. Vance's records on abortion have been accurately conveyed in the mainstream media?
I think there's a big light being shown right now on the fact that Donald Trump, compared to the rest of the Republican Party, does not seem as hardline on abortion. Based on analysis, it doesn't seem that he personally has that strong of an opinion on it. He seems personally reticent to lean into the issue because it does not poll well for Republicans. So yes and no. I think media has really, you know, focused on that shift. But at the end of the day, J.D. Vance is anti-abortion. And I don't know that the extent to which he wishes to criminalize and prosecute abortions is being correctly reported in the media now.
And finally, can you put this in the bigger picture, post-Dobbs, post the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which President Trump has proudly talked about his Supreme Court that overturned Roe v. Wade, though there is a lot of talk of this in the Project 2025. When it comes to the much smaller Republican National Platform, abortion is only referenced once.
It seems to be this issue that Republicans love and hate. Some members of the party can't seem to help embrace it, and others want to move away from it as far as possible. What we do know in the Project 2025 plan outlined by former members of Trump's administration and the Heritage Foundation, there is an active plan to expand the CDC surveillance powers over abortion. People behind Project 2025, conservatives, want to track people who have abortion. They want to know who is performing abortions, and ultimately what the purpose of prosecuting is the future we're going towards.
Veronica Riccobene, reporter and producer with The Lever. We'll link to your new article, J.D. Vance Wants Police to Track People Who Have Abortions. Coming up, a federal court has rejected a lawsuit accusing President Biden of being complicit in genocide in Gaza. Back in 30 seconds. By Freddie Henchy and the Soul Setters. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Gaza. A three-judge panel, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, has rejected a lawsuit accusing President Biden of being complicit in genocide in Gaza. The judges agreed with a lower court that the courts cannot review foreign policy decisions made by the executive branch. The Center for Constitutional Rights has sued President Biden, accusing him of failing to prevent genocide. The legal group sought an emergency order to block Biden, as well as Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, from providing further military funding, arms, and diplomatic support to Israel. Lawsuit filed on behalf of a group of Palestinian plaintiffs. We go now to Catherine Gallagher, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Can you talk about the significance of the court dismissing your case, Kate?
Good morning, Amy, and thank you very much for having us on this very busy morning and for bringing attention back to Gaza, where there is an ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people. And so it is against that backdrop that we are really deeply, not only disappointed, but troubled by the unanimous decision of the Court of Appeals from the Ninth Circuit to dismiss our case. And just to step back and explain what this case is, back in November, Defense for Children International Palestine, El-Haq, three Palestinians in Gaza living under the genocidal assault, and five Palestinian Americans brought forward this case framing U.S. conduct as complicity or aiding and abetting genocide and failing to prevent what was already in November a serious risk of genocide. So they filed this case in federal court, invoking clearly established law, the duty to prevent genocide and the prohibition against aiding and abetting genocide, which is codified in U.S. criminal law. It is in the Genocide Convention, and it has been recognized, including by the Biden administration, as binding customary international law. So the plaintiffs turned to the courts and asked the courts to please put an injunction to stop the flow of two-ton bombs falling on Palestinian children, women, the entire population across the Gaza Strip, to stop the weapons being used in an aerial bombardment to maintain a total siege, denying food, fuel, energy, electricity, and decimating the health infrastructure, bombing hospitals and doctors. This is the case that was filed in November. And it has been supported over the many months of litigation by a robust factual record, including findings by the International Court of Justice that there is a plausible genocide in Gaza, supported by statements and reports from UN experts, affidavits by former State Department officials, expert opinions by the world's leading genocide expert, William Shabbas, and by historians of genocide and Holocaust studies here in the United States, that this is indeed a plausible unfolding genocide in Gaza. And so it is against that backdrop, where there is a strong factual and legal case and unambiguous legal obligations on President Biden and Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Austin to not aid and abet genocide, is against that backdrop that the court yesterday abdicated its role and said that whenever foreign policy is invoked, the courts need to step back. They essentially said that foreign policy and conditions of war, they did not mention genocide. They did not say that this is an unfolding genocide in Gaza, but that conditions of war are ones where there really has to be deference to the executive branch, and that there isn't a role for the courts to hold executive conduct against black letter law and make declarations when executive conduct has exceeded what the president and his cabinet members are permitted to do. And so they have said that this case needs to be dismissed and essentially given the blank check to carry out any kind of conduct that the executive wants in times of genocide, in times of war, the blank check that the Supreme Court warned against and said did not exist back in the post 9/11 days in a series of cases.
I want to play for you before we get to the end of this show. I want to play for you a clip of Scott Anderson, director of the UN's refugee efforts in Gaza, talking about the aftermath of Israel's bombing on Saturday of El Mawasi. That was designated as a safe zone in Khan Yunis. The attacks killed at least 90 Palestinians and injured hundreds more. CNN reports at least one U.S.-made munition was used in the airstrike, identifying the tail fin of a joint direct attack munition. That's a JDAM, a Boeing-manufactured GPS-guided kit. This is Scott Anderson.
On Saturday, I visited Nasser Hospital after a strike in the safe zone of Mawasi, and the hospital itself is in Khan Yunis. I've been in Gaza for 9 months, and I witnessed some of the most horrific scenes I've seen in the 9 months that I've been here. The health facility was overstretched. There were more than 100 people injured. The air was filled with the smell of blood, and one health worker was mopping up pools of blood on the floor using only water because there aren't sufficient supplies of disinfectant material or other cleaning supplies to stop the spread of infection. There's not enough beds, hygiene supplies, sheeting, mattresses, or scrubs, and many patients were treated on the ground or on waiting room benches without disinfectant, and this puts even treatable injuries at risk of sepsis and much more significant complications. Ventilator systems were not working due to electrical problems. And as I walked through the hospital and talked to families and children, we saw toddlers who were double amputees, children paralyzed and unable to receive treatment because they don't have the equipment at the hospital in Khan Yunis, and others who were separated from their parents. And we also saw mothers and fathers searching frantically within the hospital for their children, unsure if they were alive. One mother I talked to told me that she was told to move to Rafah because it would be safe there. And then she was told to move to Mawasi because it would be safe there. And unfortunately for her and her family, that was not true. And I think the words of this mother are a reminder that nowhere is safe in Gaza, and no one is safe in Gaza. That family had three children impacted by the blast. One child was completely uninjured, miraculously. Another child was paralyzed, and the other son was killed. I mentioned that there's nowhere safe in Gaza. And I think we saw that over the weekend, both with what happened in Mawasi, but also the incident at Beach Camp, where 25 other people were killed. And what's urgently needed is a complete ceasefire for all parties to the conflict to protect the civilians wherever they are, but especially in UN schools and hospitals.
That's Scott Anderson, director of the UN's refugee efforts in Gaza, director of UNRWA affairs in Gaza. Catherine Gallagher, your senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, your case was just dismissed. Talk about what your efforts are now going to be and how what he's describing that happened, you know, well after you brought your lawsuit in El Mawasi, an Israel-designated safe zone that killed nearly 100 Palestinians and injured 300 more means.
Amy, I wish that the clip that we just heard was an unprecedented account, but unfortunately it is stories like that, accounts like that, that we've been hearing for 9 months of Palestinians being forced from one supposed safe area to another and being bombed, whether women, children, and in this case, there have been almost 15,000 children that have been killed and 20,000 that are disappeared, that we don't know if they are buried under rubble, if they are detained in Israeli prisons, we don't know where they are. So over the course of these 9 months where that account time and time again has been heard, what we've also heard is that indication that U.S. weapons are being used, and U.S. weapons continue to be sent. So if we have not yet succeeded through the courts, and we will consider our next options, whether in domestic courts or in foreign courts or before international bodies where we continue to press this case, we will also be bringing the case to those who are complicit. I think it's time for weapons companies, you mentioned Boeing in that clip, to stop sending weapons. There are legal responsibilities and, frankly, moral responsibilities.
We have 5 seconds.
We call on the Biden administration to heed its at least moral responsibility and stop aiding and abetting genocide.
Catherine Gallagher, Senior Staff Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a Director of Development to lead our fundraising team. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with my